Thank you, Sterling. Good to see you. All right. How's everybody doing? Great. Wow. Get that a little lower. I'm not that tall. Well, we are ready to start. We have so much to go through. As I was studying this week, looking at what we're going to be doing today, it was it's a monumental task, and you're going to be great students, I know that, and we're going to work through it. I was talking to Pastor Mike like about, 20, 30 minutes ago, and he said, well, wait a second. He said, you're going to go through Ignatius of Antioch, Polycarp, and Justin Martyr all in an hour? And I said, we'll podcast it and show it to you because the students here are smart, and we're going to be able to work through it. Hey, as you have your outline in front of you, the very nice pink one, Ron, you picked pink today. Well, you know, here's the deal. We're doing the martyrs today. I was thinking maybe red or, you know, something along that line. Not pink, but that's okay. Thanks. First thing I want to tell you about is a book that I am pushing. It's in our bookstore. I've been ahead of the game this time, so when you go over to the bookstore, we have these books in stock. It's called The Story of Christianity. Justo Gonzalez is the author. This is a phenomenal book. Now, this book is an introductory book. It's an overview, and it takes you from the post-apostolic period all the way to what he calls the dawn of the Reformation, exactly where our class is going. Justo Gonzalez, a Cuban guy, studied and went to seminary, actually in Havana. Very, very smart guy. Wrote all of his stuff in Spanish as a Cuban man. And then we got it translated into English in the last, 25 years or so. But this is a phenomenal book. Matter of fact, if you've been to church, you got to see some of our Hispanic pastors up. This is the kind of stuff that we're using over there. He's written extensively in theology and other areas. And again, this book is a great survey. What it'll do, it'll give you like 3 pages worth of Justin Martyr, and you'll read it and go, man, I need to read more about this guy. And he takes care of that too, because he provides a really good bibliography after every chapter, helping you to select other books. So this is in our bookstore. I'm going to pass it around. It is a phenomenal book. Now, let's see what we're going to start with. Does everyone still have this map? Okay. Do we give this map out to everybody? So everybody still has this. This is an important map for us to have in hand. We're going to be talking about 3 guys that are really, really important. We're keeping them in chronological order, so they're going to help us. The first guy that we're going to look at is Ignatius of Antioch. And I want to show you where Antioch is. There's Jerusalem. Antioch is approximately right there where that red dot is. So we're going to be talking about Antioch today. We're going to be talking about Smyrna and Ephesus, which is in this area, and we'll be talking about Rome. Matter of fact, I've got a different map that'll show us where Antioch is right here. Now, Antioch is in modern-day Turkey, okay? And in the Bible times in the 1st and 2nd century, Antioch was actually considered to be part of Syria and the Assyrian kingdom. And today, if you travel to Antioch, and as a matter of fact, one of the missionaries we're supporting that's in Amman, Jordan, and we're doing some work in Irbid, which is in northern Jordan, and then across the border, actually, we're doing some things in Damascus, and in southern Turkey, we're starting to do some work here in Antioch, and there are still Christians in Antioch, if you could believe that, to this day. So we're going to be looking at Antioch. We're going to be looking at Smyrna, which is up here, and where's Don? Don Langston? Don, I ask you this every week. Don, what's the modern name for Smyrna?
Izmir.
Izmir, thank you. Don, if you don't know Don Langston, Don Langston is our valedictorian and brightest guy in our class, and I call on him often when I get stumped because I couldn't remember the name Izmir. Don could, and many of us that went on the trip to Turkey got to spend some significant time, and I'm going to show some pictures of Izmir here to you in a little bit. So we're going to be looking at Izmir, and Izmir isn't very far from Ephesus, and some characters from Ephesus come to Smyrna that we'll talk about. One of those characters, Onesimus, who we find in the book of Philemon, becomes a bishop of Ephesus, and when Ignatius comes to Smyrna on his tour before he goes to be martyred in Rome, Onesimus is one of those characters that comes the 15 to 20 miles from Ephesus up to Smyrna to greet Ignatius. And then obviously we're going to talk a lot about Rome. So there's our map, and I just want to always keep that in front of us. And you see Roman numeral 2, there should have been a handout that is a blue handout that says Pliny the Younger and Trajan. Anyone remember who Trajan is? If you don't, you should also have this handout in front of you, our second century emperor's handout. And briefly, I want to go through and make sure we have a good understanding of who our emperors are in the Roman Empire. Trajan, if you remember, ruled from 98 to 117, and he is the adopted son of the emperor that was before him, Nerva. Now, you'll get used to this, I hope, when you look at Roman emperors. Very rarely do they have biological kids that they promote into the big seat of the Caesar Augustus seat. Rather, they have people that they adopt through other marriages or other family members that they believe are brighter and better and more capable of running the Roman Empire. And so for Trajan, he was adopted by Nerva. When Nerva dies, Trajan takes over, and he runs things from 90 to 117. Now, you can also look at Hadrian. Now, Hadrian, believe it or not, is also the adopted son of, play along with me, Trajan. So when Trajan is in power, he needs somebody that he can succeed or give succession to the Roman Empire to, and he thinks it's Hadrian. Hadrian's not his blood relative. He adopts Hadrian into his family, sets him up. He becomes Caesar Augustus, and he's an amazing Caesar Augustus. And then after that, Antoninus Pius. And we'll talk about him because Antoninus Pius is someone that encounters Justin the Martyr. And he is in power from 138 to 161, and he is the adopted son of Hadrian. You're getting the idea, James. Very good. And Trajan, Hadrian, and Antoninus Pius all die of natural causes. They're not assassinated like many of the emperors are. And then after that, you have Lucius Verus, and he was the adopted son of Antonios. Good. And then he dies of natural causes. And then a guy that you've all heard of is Marcus Aurelius. And Marcus Aurelius is in power from 161 to 180. It's not a typo because you see Commodus after that. It says 177. Frequently what happened is there would be co-emperors, and for 3 years, Marcus Aurelius and Commodus were co-emperors together. Marcus Aurelius was the adopted son of? There you go. You've got it, but you're wrong this time. He is actually the adopted son, and it was a trick, of Antoninus. And both Lucius and Marcus were adopted by Antoninus Pius both. Now, he was also, Marcus Aurelius was an amazing guy, and we'll talk a lot about him in 2 weeks. And this is a guy that has written extensively, is an extremely bright man, and we'll talk a little bit more about him, like I said, in a couple weeks. Now, he also dies of natural causes. Isn't that interesting that from Trajan all the way to Marcus Aurelius, every one of those Caesars, when there's a transition of power, die of natural causes. Now, that's going to be interrupted when we have Commodus. He is actually assassinated by a conspiracy through the Senate, and he is also the natural son. Here's one natural son. Commodus is the natural son of Marcus Aurelius. And then Pertinax is in power for about 3 months, and he's assassinated. Matter of fact, the Senate takes Pertinax, and they lift him up, and they say, this is the guy we want to be Caesar Augustus. He's amazing. And he's on the job for a couple of months, and then the Senate realizes they've made a grievous error, and the guy's incompetent. So what do? They put a hit on him and actually strangle him and kill him. And they raise up and appoint Didius Julianus, and he becomes the appointed. He becomes the appointed Caesar Augustus. And notice now there's no adopted sons any longer. And he's in power for a very short period. And then Septimius Severus becomes in power after that. And he's a general, and he seizes power and just takes it over. Now, as you remember this, think about Trajan, Hadrian, and Marcus Aurelius. Out of that 100-year period, those three men rule for about 57 of those years and have a profound impact on the Roman Empire, which I'm going to show you in a moment. I want you to think about your own country that you live in when we have a succession of power. In the Roman Empire, frequently a succession of power was through blood and through assassinations. And very rarely, although it happens in the history of our country, our succession of power is through voting and democracy in a whole different way. Could you imagine for a moment if George Bush was appointed to be Caesar Augustus of the United States? He would be Caesar Augustus until he died, until, you know, Nancy Pelosi and a number of those people strangled him and killed him and put somebody else in power. But we laugh about that, and that's exactly what would happen, because that's what happens in the Roman Empire. So I don't want you to think it's a far-off place, even though it is. People are people, and that's the way they made decisions, and that's the way they changed things. Now, Trajan does something that's really important to Christians, and I want you to pull out the Pliny the Younger's letter to Emperor Trajan. Somewhere on it, write down 1 Peter chapter 1, and in your own time, because we are going to fly today, 1 Peter chapter 1, you'll see that Peter is responsible for planting a church in Bithynia, and that's exactly where Pliny the Elder is hanging out, and he is the leader, the Roman council in Bithynia, and he is running into a problem with Christians. And I'll let you read the entire letter that Pliny the Younger sends to Emperor Trajan, and we'll read Trajan's response to it on the backside in a moment here. But the gist of what Pliny is saying, he's a Roman guy, and he's becoming a little bit irritated with the Christians. And he doesn't know what to do with them, because the Christians are not bowing their knee to Trajan. And Trajan was an emperor who demanded worship of emperors, of which he was one. And the people that were living in the colonies, like Bithynia, were told, you need to worship Trajan. And not only do you need to worship Trajan, but you need to worship the gods, whether they're Roman gods or Greek gods, Jupiter perhaps, you need to burn incense to them. And what was happening is Pliny the Elder, as a leader, was encountering Christians and saying, hey, you guys got to burn the incense here, and you've got to worship either Trajan or these gods. And these Christians were folding their arms going, no, we're only going to worship Jesus. And it presented a huge problem in the colonies. So Pliny the Elder doesn't know what to do, so he writes the emperor. And he lays out the problem. I just did it in a very succinct and quick way for you. But look at the response that Trajan provides for Pliny the Younger on the back page. My Pliny, you have taken the method which you ought in examining the causes of those that have been accused as Christians. For indeed, no certain and general form of judging can be ordained in this case. These people are not to be sought for. But if they are accused and convicted, they are to be punished. But with this caution, that he who denies himself to be a Christian and makes it plain that he's not so by supplicating to our gods, although he has been so formerly, may be allowed to be pardoned upon his repentance. And as for the libels sent without an author, they would ought have no place in any accusation whatsoever, for that would be a thing of very ill example and not agreeable to my reign. Now here's a guy like Trajan, basically putting in a don't ask, don't tell type of policy. What he's saying to Pliny is, don't go out there looking for these Christians. Don't go out there and trying to kill them. Don't initiate it. But if they come to you and there's a solid accusation of their Christianity, offer them the opportunity to repent and let them worship one of the gods. Or let them worship me. And if they burn even the smallest amount of incense, and if they bow their knees somewhat to me, then pardon them and let them go. However, if they don't, then they need to be punished. And the punishment in the Roman Empire for being agnostic and an atheist, because they would call Christians atheists because they believe they were God, they say the atheists will die. And that was what happened. I have pictures of... This is in Pergamum in Turkey. I took this picture, and that is one of the nicest, from an archaeological standpoint at least, temples to. Does anyone remember? That's a temple to Trajan. Yeah, You can see it's a beautiful temple, huge, and it sits on the very, very top of the hill in Pergamum, up, and it's higher than the auditorium that is there. The auditorium that's in Pergamum is amazing. It's a very, very large auditorium and amphitheater, and this sits on top of it. It's probably at the highest point on the mountain of Pergamum. And I think I've got another picture of it. And it is an amazing structure. But one of the things that you need to know, and my wife tells me this often, and it's a philosophy that we find with Pliny the Elder and with Trajan's edict and how to deal with the Christians. My wife always tells me when I take a picture and just hang it on the wall arbitrarily, she says, don't do that, because if you do that, that picture will probably hang in that spot and in our house the rest of the time that we live here. And we moved about 3 years ago from a house we lived in for 17 years, and I pulled down picture after picture that I had put up, not the ones that she had put up or the ones we did together, that I put up 17 years when we moved into the home. And this is exactly what happens with Trajan. Trajan puts out this edict on how to deal with Christians and persecution, and this is exactly how things are run inside the empire for years and years and years to come, until Diocletian comes in the next century, and we'll talk a little bit about that moving on a little bit later. Okay, so everyone understand that? That makes sense? Yes? Nod? Okay, good. Let's go to Roman numeral 3, and let's meet our very, very first a martyr in our church father. As a matter of fact, before we pop there, you see where it says, you see that funny Greek stuff that's going on there? Do you see that? The M, and it looks like a P, but that's really a rho, an R in Greek. Martyr, martyr. And what I want you to do, that's a martyr. What I want you to write next to it, the definition for a martyr is a witness. It's a witness. And that's what these men will do. They'll witness. Now, lexically, when we define the word martyr, we would say it's a witness to really get in front of somebody and provide a testimony, and that's what they do. It really never anticipates the word itself by itself that as a witness that you will die. And that's something that the Christians borrow in the sense that you'll find that Justin will provide a witness. You'll see that Polycarp will provide a witness. You'll see in a moment here Ignatius will provide a witness. And as they provide this witness, their witness will be so strong and so repulsive also to the Roman Empire that they'll die for that witness. So Ignatius was a guy that was born in 35 AD, and he was martyred and died in about 108. Theophorus. What's Theo mean? God. And Phoros is a Greek word for a bearer. And that's what they called Ignatius. Ignatius was the God bearer. That was kind of his nickname in the community. We know the Greeks had founded Antioch in 300 BC. We also know that at the time of Ignatius, this was a huge city. There were almost 500,000 people that were living in Antioch during the second century. Antioch was the third most important city in the Roman Empire behind, what's the first one? Number one's easy, Rome. And what's number two? Alexandria, which is in the continent of Africa. Very good. And I think I've got some pictures of Antioch. Yep, these are some pictures of Antioch. I think there's a big Muslim community there today. You can see the minaret. Yep, ready to take off. This is called the Orontes River. The Orontes River is about 16 miles. So you got downtown Antioch is not exactly a port city, and it's about 16 miles to the ocean from there. This is what they call the Grotto of St. Peter and St. Paul, and this is thought to be the location, traditional location of Paul and Peter. And remember that Antioch is a launching spot, especially for Paul, for his mission trips. And we say that right there on our outline. I want you to fill it in. The Apostle Paul used Antioch as his base of operation for his missions trips. Paul introduces the city of Antioch to a gospel that had access to God without what? Strict Old Testament requirements. Because if you remember, we're going to talk about that in a moment. There are people that are in the church that are called Judaizers, and they want to attach dietary law and circumcision and Old Testament requirements to Christianity. And that's something that in the city of Antioch we'll find a good fight going on. It's in Antioch that believers first refer to themselves as Christians. And we find that in Acts 11, verse 26. Ignatius, although he lived in the time of all the apostles, Ignatius was really a disciple of Paul. And Paul, remember, from right up the street in Tarsus, not very far away, also sitting in Antioch, we talked about the fact that Paul was using that as a launching ground for every single missions trip that he went on. Ignatius became the bishop of Antioch, and he fought two things. One of those things is Gnosticism. G-N-O-S-T-I-C-I-S-M. So he fights Gnosticism. We'll talk about that in a moment. And he fights Judaizers. J-U-D-A-I-Z-E-R-S. Judaizers. And he fights them within his own congregation. Isn't that interesting? You know, we always think about theological infighting and fighting. We think that a lot of the fighting occurs outside the church. And you're going to learn in this class that much of the fighting is going to be between people that are adherents to the Christian faith and have very different ideas of what the Christian faith is really all about. Now, the Judaizers imposed law upon the gospel. And I will cite for you Galatians chapter 2, verses 11 through 21. And in Galatians 2, verses 11 through 21, this is where Paul will oppose Peter to his face and tell Peter, what are you doing? You're hanging out with the Judaizers, and you're sympathetic to adding Old Testament ceremonial law to Christianity. And he actually, in Galatians chapter 2, formally rebukes Peter. And Peter does repent of that. And in his own church later, down the way, you know, this happened in 40 or 50 A.D., and now, a little bit later, Ignatius is in charge of the same church in Antioch, and that problem is still a problem inside the church. So they had the Judaizer issue, and then Gnosticism, our Greek word is kenosis, and kenosis means knowledge, and Gnosticism teaches a secret knowledge. And it's a secret knowledge about the inception of the universe. Physical matter is thought to be evil, and as a result of that, there's something called docetism that happens. And docetism, doce is like a ghost almost. And docetists believe that Jesus Christ never took a human form, and that he was only a spirit. And what the apostles encountered in the Gospels when they saw him, he didn't really have a human body, but it was just an image of that. And we know that to be a heresy. Look with me in 2 John 7 very quickly, and you can see this heresy. John is already dealing with this in a couple of different places in this Gnosticism. Now, I'm giving you Gnosticism in its briefest and maybe its easiest way of discussing it and introducing it to you today. Trust me, in the upcoming weeks, we'll be talking in depth about Gnosticism because it just doesn't go away here. Actually, it grows. In a lot of ways, Gnosticism is still part of our church, not our church here, but part of the church today. Look at 2 John and drop your eyes to verse number 7. You see the verse number 7. For many deceivers have gone out into the world, and those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in what? In the flesh. Such a one is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look back with me in 1 John chapter number 4. 1 John 4, verse number 2, just very quickly. John says this, "By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God." And you see that John already in his writings is dealing with docetism that is inside the church, denying the bodily form of Jesus Christ. And that is part of the Gnostic heresy, one small part of it. There are many other parts. And I just wanted to introduce that to you this morning and give you an idea that Pastor Ignatius is fighting inside his own church Gnosticism and Judaizing. Now, the writings of Ignatius include 6 letters to churches, including letters he wrote to Smyrna, Ephesus, and Philadelphia, and to Rome. And he wrote a letter to a person, and that person was Polycarp. Now, Ignatius's road to martyrdom followed much of Paul's third mission trip, a lot of his third mission trip. Now, I want to read to you part of the letter that Ignatius writes to the church at Rome. Now he writes to the church at Rome because what's happening here is that Ignatius is in Antioch. He is tried and convicted, and the deal is that they want to take this big heavy hitter, the bishop of Ignatius, and they're going to walk him under Roman guard all the way from Antioch to Rome. And they want to do it so they get there just in time for the end of their winter games. And he's going to be the main course at the winter games inside the Colosseum, which was finished in what year? 80 AD, under the rulership of Titus. And so in 80, that Colosseum's all done. And now the main event is going to be the martyrdom of Ignatius in Rome. But on the way, Ignatius takes the same route pretty much that Paul takes in his third missionary trip. And so he passes through Ephesus and Smyrna and Pergamum. And other Christians are allowed to come near him and to encourage him and talk with him. And notice that those people are not taken by the Roman garrison and killed. And here's Trajan's law in order again. You know, they got their man, and he wouldn't repent. And so other people could encourage him, and without the Romans, saying, "You nasty Christians, and we'll kill you," all the people that are around Ignatius, they didn't kill him. And he starts writing letters, and he writes letters from Smyrna because there's a groundswell. Ignatius is a popular guy, and people in the Christian church don't want to see him killed. And so he writes a letter ahead to Rome because he's getting wind that the Romans are going to try to break him out. They're going to try to do something to save and spare his life. Listen to his own words as he writes to the church at Rome, telling them, "Don't do this. For it is not my desire to act towards you as a man pleaser, but as pleasing to God, even as also we please Him. For neither shall I ever have such an opportunity of attaining God nor His will. Now I want you to be silent. You need to be silent. If you've never envied anyone or taught anyone, now I desire that those things may be confirmed. Only request in my behalf, both inward and outward strength, is that I not only speak because I want to advance the gospel, but that I not only merely be called a Christian, but really found to be one." And he goes on to say, and this is the name of the chapter that he has, "Allow me to fall prey to the wild beasts." Because what they had in store for Ignatius in the Colosseum was they were going to put him on the Colosseum floor and release lions and leopards and all kinds of wild animals and watch these animals devour him. And he says, "I write to all the churches and impress upon them all that I shall willingly die for God unless he hinder me. I beseech you not to show any unseasonable goodwill towards me. Suffer me to become food for the wild beasts, through whose instrumentality it will be granted to me to attain God. I am the wheat of God, and I am ground by the teeth of the wild beasts, that I may be found the pure bread of God. Rather entice the wild beasts, that they may become my tomb, and may leave nothing of my body, so that when I have fallen asleep in death, I may not be found troublesome to anyone in the church. Then shall I be a true disciple of Jesus Christ, when the world shall not see so much of my body. Entreat the Lord for me that by these instruments I may be found a sacrifice to God. I do not, as Peter and Paul, issue commandments unto you. They were apostles of Christ, but I am of very least just a believer like you. They were free as the servants of God, while I am, even until now, a servant. But when I suffer, I shall be a freed man of Christ." And he goes on and on in this letter, telling these people that I want to die. It is God's will that I die. My goal is to advance the gospel. Please don't get in the will of God. And in graphic terms, in the letter he writes to the Roman church, he's telling them, back off and let God do what he's going to do, because there will be more glory found in my martyrdom in the Colosseum than there will be in you trying to find my release. And that's basically what he writes to the church at Rome. Well, in our outline, it tells us that he reaches Rome on the 20th of December, which was the last day of the games I was telling you about, and was brought at once before the prefect to whom the emperor's letter was delivered. And at the prefect's command, the prisoner was hurried off to the Colosseum, where two fierce lions were let out, and Ignatius was at once killed. And thus, his prayer and his direction to the Roman church for a martyr's death were certainly answered. When we look at a life like Ignatius, I mean, last week we looked at John, the last apostle, who now hands the baton to a guy like Ignatius. Ignatius was faithful inside his own church to take on the Judaizers, to take on people inside his church that were into the Gnostic heresy and Docetism, and taking his own life and minimizing what would happen to him, he was still willing for the advancement of the gospel to basically go on tour and leave Antioch with a group of people, encouraging others, writing letters to other churches, knowing that the inevitability of his painful and brutal death at the hands of the Roman Empire awaited him. And he put all of that to the side for the glory of God, because he felt that it would be better for him to die than to live. There was gain in death, and that's what God's will for him. Now, the book I handed out to you about the history of the church has several really good articles, or books rather, about Ignatius of Antioch. So if you'd like to dig deeper into his life, I suggest you do it. Some of the very inexpensive ways you can do it is go to your Google, type in Ignatius of Antioch. All his letters will be pulled up. You could read through all of them. You could read through what he had to say to the church at Philadelphia, what he had to say to the church at... He had a lot to say. And what you'll find is most of it is going to be, don't save me. And the other one is calling people to live a holy and a pure life. And it's great reading. So after Ignatius dies this brutal death in 108, we have another man. And if you were with me in the summer when we talked about the seven churches of Revelation, we told the Polycarp story. I asked you for homework to kind of run through it. How many people actually read a little bit on Polycarp? Was it interesting reading? This guy was a really interesting man. He was the bishop of Smyrna, and as Don tells us, Izmir, the modern city. Here's a picture of Izmir that I took from the bus. It's a great city, and here's an overview shot. It's a port city. 99% of the people that live in Izmir today are Muslim, but I will tell you that their Muslim and love for Islam is very similar to people's love in the United States for Jesus Christ. It's pretty secularized out, and I believe that if the next ruler of Turkey came in and promised them great benefit programs and social security and promised to take care of them and asked them to worship Buddha, they would all become Buddhists. And so I don't think, at least in the western side of Turkey, where we spent a lot of time, that there was this real strong fundamental love for Islam. Now, on the eastern side of Turkey, it's wholly different, and that's where you'll find most of your fundamentalists. So here's an overshot of Izmir. Right here is a small area where there are some ruins. And Izmir is a lot like Thessaloniki, if you went on the trip with us. All the good stuff, archaeologically, is underneath that building and this garage and these homes over here. And for us to really learn more historically and archaeologically, we'd have to go tear the whole city down, just like we'd have to do to Thessaloniki. And we're not in a position to do it, and I don't think the people that live there today would like that idea if we eminent domain the entire city of Smyrna for archaeological work. But we do have this one little area in here, and you can see a little bit more of a close-up shot. Can you see it? You can see the ruins that are there. It's a small area of ruins, just like Thessaloniki. And here's a picture from a boat. Many of us hung out at this port right here, or this little park rather, and you could walk all the way along this to shopping areas and open markets. And I really liked Izmir. I thought Izmir was an amazing city. And here's some of the close-ups again of some of the things. We don't have a lot. It's not impressive. And matter of fact, if you came with us on the trip, do you remember going with me to look at the ruins of Izmir? We didn't even take you there. It just wasn't enough to really see. We really wanted to maximize our time in Ephesus and other places. And here are some of the gold coins that we find in some of the museums in the area. And this is the gold coin and the emperor that is right here. Anyone tell by the look on that guy's face that is none other than Trajan? And we have lots of, by the way, we have lots and lots of these coins of Roman emperors. So you see the list of Roman emperors you have there? We have coins from all of those Roman emperors. Because every time there was a Roman emperor, what do? They minted their own coin like every other good god would do and provide it for their people. So here's Polycarp in Smyrna. Polycarp was a great disciple, we said last week, of the Apostle John. And I said that perhaps John even took Polycarp through partners if it was available back then. I'm not sure if it was. But Smyrna is a port city. It's about 20 miles to the west of Ephesus. And it is called today, as Don always tells us, Izmir. And Izmir is the third largest city today in Turkey. The largest is Istanbul. And the second largest is the capital of Turkey, Ankara. And then the third largest would be Izmir. Izmir has almost 3 million people living there. Polycarp was the main leader of the church in Smyrna. And that's an interesting thing, too, is that the churches that we'll run into at the very inception of the church have a one-leader model. And they have a plurality of presbyteros, of elders, but these churches have one guy. Like in Antioch, it was our good friend Ignatius. Here in Smyrna at this time, it's Polycarp. And one of the reasons they do this is they kind of model themselves after the apostles. And the apostles are the one-guy leaders of towns that they go to. And these one-guy leaders are considered to be the ultimate shepherd, the ultimate guardian of theology in the area. And they stand up strong, and people are like, that's the guy we know. So if I live in Antioch and I'm moving, let's say, to Smyrna, I'm going to say, look, if I go to Smyrna, I'm going to go find Polycarp because I know what Polycarp stands for. Now, underneath Polycarp, are there elders? Yeah, he's got associate pastors like you wouldn't believe that are in this system. So we have this guy Polycarp, who's the one main leader in Smyrna. He fought against a guy named Marcion. And Marcion, if you know anything about this guy, Marcion rejected the Old Testament scriptures as a whole. He just rejected the whole thing. We'll talk a lot about Marcion. We talk about heretics next week. But just so you know, as an opener, as an introduction, that Marcion, good guy or bad guy? Bad guy. Marcion's a bad guy because he's got bad theology. I'm sure he's a nice man, but he's got bad theology, so we're going to call him a bad guy. And he just rejects the entire Old Testament, all of it. Noah, Abrahamic covenant, all of that, and says, no, don't buy it, don't believe it. I'm staying here in the New Testament alone. And we'll talk more and kind of develop his philosophy and theology when we talk about some of the main heretics next week. So Polycarp, when he is told that he is going to die, that the Romans are after him and they want to try him and eventually kill him, he actually hides. Did you know that? He didn't just come right out and say, "Kill me." He goes and goes into hiding, and some of his disciples hide him in a home. And while he's hiding, there's another man. His name is Quintus, who offered himself as a martyr. He came before the Romans and said, "Kill me because I'm a Christian." And after he offered himself as a martyr, he actually weakens and repents and accepts the opportunity to be involved in worshiping the gods of Rome and the gods of Greece, and also emperor worship. And he bails out in front of all the people in the church. Because can you imagine that for a second? Your whole church is all watching. And here comes the leader, and everybody's got folded arms, and they're watching the leader. What's he going to do? is he really, he's been teaching us, is he really going to die for his faith? Or has this all just been a joke for him? And Quintus gets up and his knees knock, and he is one of the under shepherds, and he weakens and says, I don't want to die. On that, Polycarp does come out, and here's some of the quote I'll give you at the end. Amidst an angry mob, the Roman proconsul took pity on such a gentle old man, and he's urging Polycarp to proclaim who is Lord. Yeah. Could you do that? In 155, which is when Polycarp died, who is the Caesar? You got it there on your list? Shout it out if you have it. Antonios is, right? Okay, so he's the Caesar, and so Polycarp told to say that Antonios is God. He is Lord. And how old was Polycarp at the time? 86 years old. And as an 86-year-old man, this guy's kind of reasoning with him, going, come on, we don't really do this. Polycarp, you're 86 years old. Could you please just a small snippet? And if only Polycarp would make this declaration and offer a small pinch of incense to Caesar's statue, he would escape torture and death. And to Polycarp, he responds this way, quote, 86 years I've served Christos, and never did he do any wrong. And how can I blaspheme my king who saved me? Steadfast in his stand for Christ, Polycarp refused to compromise his beliefs and thus was burned at the stake. And I can tell you that his church, bishops, when the bishop of Smyrna was up there at the trial and when he was burned at the stake, his church watched, and they watched every part of it. And they wondered, is Polycarp really in this thing? And then a wise man once said that no one will die for a lie. No one will die for a lie. And Polycarp would not die for a lie. He died for the truth. And his church watched him. And his church strengthened as a result of it. They saw the leader die for his faith. It didn't make them run away. We don't find out later that the church at Smyrna, you know, just disbands. They had a new leader. They put that new leader up in the church. You know what happened to that church? It grew. It grew. Let's turn to the backside and take a look at one of my favorite characters, Justin Martyr. He's next in line. See our ages, 103. Who is, when he was born, who was the Caesar? Trajan. Good, and when he died, and he's going to be martyred, who is the leader? Who's that? What's that? It was dual leadership, good. And who are the two guys? Okay, through all that mumbling and everything else, I think you got it, that's good. I hope. Okay. So I just want you to know there are Roman emperors that are in charge of these murders of Christians. And let's learn just a little bit about Justin Martyr. He was born in the region of Samaria near the ancient city of Shechem, S-H-E-C-H-E-M, Shechem. If you're, guys, if you're with us in men's Bible study, I've been teaching for 4 weeks, or I will be teaching for 4 weeks. Shechem is a pretty important city. We were talking about Shechem and Bethel and Beersheba, and this. I made the 5 freeway right in the middle of Israel and showed you how far it was from Jerusalem to Shechem to Bethel and all of that. But Bethel, or Shechem rather, is right in the middle of Samaria, and today Samaria is in the, most of it, in the West Bank. Okay, so if we wanted to go to Shechem today on one of our trips, we'd have to go through the security fence, and it's kind of a real big hassle, and there's not really a lot to see. But Shechem and most all of Samaria is in the modern day West Bank. We know that Justin Martyr was not Jewish, as he had a Latin name. He received a Greek education. Justin had a deep love of philosophy, and he went to the city of Ephesus to study philosophy. Now, we don't know for sure whether he became a Christian while he was still in Samaria or whether he became a Christian while he was in Ephesus. But somewhere along the line, he becomes converted. And not only is he converted, he's a pretty smart dude. And he is well-versed in guys like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. If you're ever wondering to keep those guys in chronological order, I always use the acronym SPA, S-P-A. That always helps me. I know that Socrates came first and that Plato was a student of Socrates and then Aristotle after that. And so this guy, Justin, was pretty smart. He had a lot of understanding in Greek wisdom. And Justin, as a new Christian, had also heard the story of Ignatius, who had passed by nearly 15 years earlier. And as a Christian, he wore a garment of the philosopher. And that garment's called a pallium, a P-A-L-L-I-U-M, pallium. And that's different than the toga. It's a little bit more squared off, and it's very simple. And it's trying to tell people in the community that you are a philosopher and that you're also a very simple man in search of wisdom. So if you're walking the streets of Ephesus and you saw someone wearing a pallium, you'd start following that guy around and start asking him questions because you knew he was a philosopher, not just a regular guy on the streets. And Justin Martyr becomes really our first Christian that we're aware of that wears the pallium. So Justin, one of his first debates was against a Jewish apologist, Trypho, and that happens in the city. Trypho is T-R-Y-P-H-O, and if you don't know how to spell it, it's in the line right below that, in the city of Ephesus. And later he publishes a dialogue with Trypho the Jew, and it's available. You can go right after this class and just type it into your Google. It is awesome stuff. And they have this very spirited debate between the truths of Judaism and the truths of Christianity. And what's really cool is you can see Justin's brilliance and his gentleness, but yet his firmness in dealing with Trypho. And he's constantly pleading with Trypho to repent and place his trust in Christ and become a completed Jew, not a halfway Jew, which is nothing at all. And it's very interesting reading, and it's free, and you can get it on the internet with no problem. Justin eventually leaves Ephesus, and he travels to Rome. And in Rome, Justin develops a Christology of Jesus as the, here comes something fun, this gets a little bit harder, Logos, L-O-G-O-S, Logos. We're going to talk a lot about this, so if this gets hazy for you right now, just hang with me because we'll clear all the haze up over the next couple of weeks about Justin's description and development of a Christology that includes the Logos. And Pastor Mike, in the upcoming weeks in his Christology class, will talk about this extensively as well. And basically, Justin defines the Logos as the rational mind of God. The rational mind of God. And what he's teaching his students is that he taught that man has access to God through the Logos, who is numerically distinct from the Father, but is unified with him as well, which sounds like the formulation of the deity of Christ and the Trinity. Okay? Now, what the Romans taught and the Greeks taught was that man had access to the ultimate God, the creator God through the Greek gods. You had all these people in the way that were pleading for you and they're intermediaries for you to the ultimate God. So remember, his audience, he is witnessing and working with really smart people that are embracing a Greco-Roman philosophy. And now what he's presenting is he's saying that Jesus is this intermediary and the Logos is the connection point between man and God the Father. And not only that, the Logos and God the Father are made of the same essence. They're the same. Now, even though they're numerically distinct from the Father, but unified with him as well, Justin also taught that the Logos had another use. And he taught that everything good from Greek philosophy, everything that Socrates and Plato and Aristotle taught, all of that came from the Logos. All of it did, because God was like a sower who scattered seeds of his own divine reason among people of all eras. And the Greek word for seed is spermata. We get our word that you know, words like sperm and things like that, becomes a seed. And what Justin was saying to the people was that through all eras, before even the incarnation of Christ, that what the Logos was doing was taking wisdom and taking knowledge and just sowing it. And so as he's sowing all of this wisdom and knowledge in the world prior to the incarnation of Christ, what that would mean is that anything Socrates had to say that was smart, the origin would be the Logos. If Plato had something bright to say, the origin would be Logos. So anything that the Greeks thought was incredibly brilliant, or any philosophy they had, the origin would always point to the Logos. And not only would it point to the Logos, but it would say that the church owned it. This is all about God, and the church owns this. Now, I'm going to go on through this in a lot more depth than today, because what we're introducing today is really the inception of the deity of Christ and how it formed, and the inception also of the Trinity. And we can't explain the Trinity in 90 seconds. But what I want to do is tell you that this man, Justin, was a man that was beginning the construction and the philosophy of how to articulate that into our world. Now, thus, all the knowledge, I said, belonged to the church. Justin wrote many works besides the dialogue with Trypho the Jew. Two of his infamous works are Apology 1 and Apology 2, and they were addressed to who? Exactly, to Emperor Antoninus and Pius, and to the Roman Senate in 155. Okay? And so he confronts them. Matter of fact, I'm going to read a little bit of it to you in a moment, of his apology to them. Now remember, an apology isn't "I'm sorry" here, right? An apology is a defense. And what Justin is doing, he becomes our first guy that is a strong philosopher and defender and apologist for the Christian faith as it grows. So here's part of the apology one. That is written to the emperor and to the Senate. I read this to my kids yesterday at breakfast, and we had a great time reading that over bacon and eggs and everything else like that. And what he's doing here in this apology, he's talking about Christian life, and he's explaining to the emperor that this is what Christian life is all about. He says, "Emperor, in our churches, the rich among us come to the aid of the poor, and we always stick together. For the many blessings we receive, we praise the Creator of everything through His Son, Jesus Christ, and through the Holy Spirit. On Sunday, everyone who lives in the city," talking about Rome, "or the countryside, gathers together in one place where the memoirs of the apostles or the writings of the prophets are read for as long as time allows." Now remember, here we're starting to talk about an authoritative Bible, a set of books. And what he's saying is, It's the writing of the apostles and the prophets. "And when the reader had finished, the leader of our community gives a sermon in which he instructs us and urges us to imitate those good teachings." Sound familiar yet? "Next, we all stand up together and offer our prayers." By the way, this is in 155 AD. "When the prayers are finished, bread and wine mixed with water are brought to us, just as described above in the preceding chapters. The leader offers his own prayers of thanksgiving to the best of his ability, while the people express their agreement by saying, Amen. Then the elements over which prayers of thanksgiving have been said are distributed to everyone and all who partake of them. The deacons also send portions to those who are absent from church that day. Those among us who are well off, if they are willing, give an offering in whatever amount seems appropriate to them." So here's a destruction of tithing, right? Because in Corinthians, what does Paul say? You know, we ought to be a hilarious givers. He doesn't say give a tenth. You know, he says give from your heart. And he provides us, with this money, we provide aid to widows and orphans, to those who are needy from sickness or some other cause, to believers who are in prison for their faith, and to Christians from other lands who may be staying with us, First Missions Program. Basically, our leader is a caretaker for everyone who is in need. Now, we hold our shared church service on Sunday because it is the first day of the week. It was on this day that God transformed the dark and formless matter to create our world. There's a good connection to the Old Testament. He wasn't like Marcion, right? It was also on this day that our Savior Jesus Christ rose from the dead, for he was crucified on Friday and he appeared on Sunday to his apostles and disciples. The things that he taught to them I now offer to you for your serious consideration. Therefore, O Emperor, if my account of the Christian religion makes it seem reasonable and true, then could you give us respect? Would you respect us for this? On the other hand, if you deem this to be ridiculous, then despise it as nonsense. But do not impose the death penalty on people who have committed no crimes, as if we were your enemies. We're not your enemies. For I give you this advanced warning. And this is how he finishes. You will certainly, Emperor, not escape the coming judgment of God if you persist in your injustice. But as for us, our prayer is that may God's will be done. So here's Justin Martyr, who lets it all hang out and gets the point across to the emperor. Now, when you get your point across to the emperor, there sometimes are consequences for it. And one of the consequences is eventually Justin and a number of his associates are sentenced to death. And the death that they experience is brutal. It is brutal. And basically, the emperor had them whipped and scourged to the point of near death. And as they were begging to die, as they were bleeding to death, then they took Justin Martyr and they beheaded him and killed him. Ignatius, Polycarp, Justin Martyr, amazing men who we know today who died for their faith. And it makes us wonder for a moment, how far would you go? Would you be like Quintus? Would you be the person running to the front saying, I'll die for faith, and when push comes to shove, you'll back away? Or will you be like any of these three men to go the whole way? You know, we think about it here today in the United States and think, well, the chances of that happening today or tomorrow, it just doesn't seem likely. But as a follower of culture and looking at countries like Canada, perhaps, and other places, and their views of biblical Christianity, the government is tightening their stance on many issues. If, for instance, in Canada, you could be thrown in jail, do you realize, for preaching anything in the Bible that condemns homosexuality? And there are pastors today that are in jail, in prison, in that country for that. So perhaps we're not as far away from the Roman Empire as maybe we would like to think. I'd like to take you to one passage very, very quickly because we're almost out of time, and it's in Philippians chapter 1. And you see where it says Roman numeral 6, your life is meant to do a couple things. And I want to hopefully encourage you to take a look at what Paul has to say to the church at Philippi just very quickly. And when you're in Philippians chapter number 1, drop your eyes to verse number 12, and I'll very quickly give you what I was thinking about as I studied these three men's lives. Verse 12 teaches us that I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. What happened to Paul? What's he talking about? He's jailed in Rome and waiting to be killed. And he's basically saying what's happened to me, the purpose is to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Your life is meant to advance the gospel. Advance the gospel. And which one of our three characters does that sound like today? Does that sound like Ignatius? As he was going to die, he goes on tour to advance the gospel. And that's what he's doing. And it'd be much easier for him to say, let's go straight to Rome. I'm not talking to anyone. I'll be sequestered, not writing any letters. But his life and who he was there. And the persecution and the imprisonment and the martyrdom was all in place to advance the gospel. Look with me a little bit further, talking about Paul's imprisonment. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. So the brothers that are watching Paul in prison become confident, and they become much more bold to speak out. Doesn't that sound like the people that were in Smyrna who were sitting and watching their bishop die? Doesn't it? Because I think that one of the things we learn from Paul, and I think we learn it here from the life of Polycarp, is that our life is also not about us, but it's meant to strengthen others and strengthen other believers. And here's Polycarp who goes to the death, goes to the death, and he knows what Quintus did before him. And he knew that one of the roles that he would have in his martyrdom and his death, it was meant also to strengthen the fellow believers that were there in Smyrna. And fellow believers like you and I that can read Polycarp's story thousands of years later and be encouraged and strengthened by his witness and the life that he lived. And finally, if we look in Philippians chapter 1 very quickly, verse number 15, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the apology, the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Who does that sound like? Doesn't that sound like Justin Martyr, who defends the gospel? And one of the things that we're meant to do, ladies and gentlemen, with our life is to defend this precious instrument of grace called the gospel. And the gospel is under fire today in the church because the Gnostic heresy is here. The Judaizers are here. The Marcions are here. The Docetists are here. They're all still here in different forms. And they're here and they're attacking a biblical gospel. And one of the things that you and I, not just the pastoral staff, but all of us, we're here to do exactly what Justin Martyr did, is to defend the gospel, to be an apologetic for the gospel. So, in 62 minutes, we looked at the lives of three men. This is the only time that we're going to look at three men. Usually we're going to look at one or two as we go through it, like next week. And what I want you to do, see the homework section? I'm actually going to make you do homework. Don, are you paying attention? Okay, because I mean, you know, I'm going to call on you first, because one of the first things we do with homework is we're going to have a little discussion from up front to you guys, and it'll be two-way. What I want you to do is this. This was a proposition. Justin Martyr always tried to reach people with the gospel from a position of common ground. I want you to think about various groups in society. Think about really smart people, you know, scientists, business people, artists, politicians, or whatever, and think also of the poor and other folks. How could Christianity be presented to some of these groups in an appealing way? And before you get excited, look at the next sentence. What might go too far as to compromise the Christian method message? What I want you to think about, though, is I don't want you to doll up the gospel and make it something it's not. But what I do want you to do is I want you to think through biblical Christianity. And Justin Martyr, who is a philosopher and an apologist, defending the gospel, providing an answer for the hope that we have in Jesus Christ in a respectful way. It calls upon us as Christians to just not sit back, but we should be lifelong learners. We should be people that are excited about the faith that we have. We should want to know all that we can know about our faith, not just to make us smarter or wiser, but rather for other people so we can bring the gospel into the scientific community. This week I'll be preaching a men's Bible study about creationism. I'm taking one verse, and that's all I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to talk about the idea that's the proposition of Scripture that says in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's all I'm going to talk about. But I want to talk and firmly root that proposition and prove that proposition as the truth as to where you and I came from. But I also want to talk about evolution. I also want to talk about three or four other views of how you and I got here and how this universe came into play. And I think that as smart thinking people here in Orange County that have just an incredible resource bank of information that we can draw from, books, websites, we could be lifelong learners. And I call you today to maybe step it up a little bit. to look at this question a bit and come back, and we'll spend 10 minutes or so talking about Justin Martyr and talking about how he perhaps would have approached this world and this culture. So all that to say, and Rick Talcott, why don't you come up here before we go into the 11 o'clock service and my boss gets really mad at me. Thanks a lot. Have a great, great day.
On your tables were our schedules.